Last week I started speaking about a model for practice, for spiritual unfolding, for inner practice, for contemplative practice, described by the Buddha as the Noble Eightfold Path, or the Noble Path with Eight Aspects. And describing the process, the contemplative process, in these lists of, you know, paths with a number of limbs. The word technically anga means literally limb, like these are your angas. And there were lists of several different numbers of limbs. This is one of them. From the same period, there was a whole practice in different, each different school had its list. So this is the one that the Buddha put forward. Mostly here, for those that are new, I'm teaching from what we could call kind of the modern Theravada Buddhist tradition. This is to say that my teacher's training and my training is primarily in, or my teaching lineage is primarily in, the type of Buddhism that is current in Southeast Asia, so Thailand, Burma, and Sri Lanka most prominently, and then influencing other places as well. And then that lineage came to the West in the form of insight meditation and some other forms of vipassana. So in that tradition, we reach back to the recorded texts that we have from the earliest Buddhist period, the teachings perhaps of the Buddha himself, or at least those written down by the monks and nuns who were his immediate followers. And so in this tradition, the path is described in this model of having eight parts. And we talked last week about the first of those, which is called view, either called right view or wise view. And the sequence of the eight begins with view. View is a way of saying that no matter what you do, it starts with what you already believe or what you take on. In other words, let's say, I want to go somewhere. Let's say I want to go across the bay into San Francisco to see a show. I could look at my motivation for wanting to do it, and I could say, well, why do I want to do it? And I would dig in, and I would find a belief. And that belief would be something like, you know, music is good, or supporting live music is good, or music is better in San Francisco, or what? I feel great when I cross the bridge. Like whatever, something is going to be behind my going to do it. And there's always a belief, right? And in a certain way, we could call this, in like political language, we would say there's an ideology, right? So the Buddha starts his system, his path, by saying that the view you hold, or the system of belief that you hold, really determines what you then do, what you then pursue. And we talked last week about one of the aspects of this initial or wise view, which is formulated in what's called the Four Noble Truths, another one of the basic bodies of teaching. Those truths are that there is pain and suffering as part of life, that it's built in to the system of having a body, being part of an ecosystem, that there is loss, that there is death, that there is both gain and loss, pleasure and pain, and that it's actually impossible, no matter what you do, to ensure the pleasant and prevent the unpleasant. And this is a theorem or a hypothesis that you are asked to take on as you begin this practice. And it's suggested that, in a way, if this doesn't ring true for you, you probably won't have the motivation to practice. You might not be here. Like, you came here because it seemed like a good idea. If you didn't really think there was something to be done about suffering, you know, maybe you should just be out listening to music. right? Because the theory is that when we get it, that pain is inevitable in life, and that pleasure can't be maintained or held onto, something will get lit in us that's a motivation to do something about that. The beginning of the Buddha's own path, the myths at least say, was that it really grew out of the experience of a very privileged young man, he was wealthy, who encountered, as he went through his city, an elderly person, a sick person, and a corpse. So the core image is of someone who is young, right? The whole like, oh, you think you're immortal. You're young, right? It said he was in his mid-20s when this happened. So think about a 25-year-old rich guy. He's had all the pleasures that wealth can buy. And he has somehow been sheltered from the reality of old age, sickness, and death up till this point. This is why it's a myth, right? Like, the story got more fancy over the centuries until it became like, you know, any time a flower even wilted in his palaces, it was secreted away at night and replaced with another fresh one. So he never even saw a flower wilt. And that's absurd, but we can think about more deeply, it's an image, right? We can think about what privilege does. That it warps the sense of reality, really, you know. And so his sense of reality was conditioned by intense wealth and privilege, and then he sees these markers, the reality of what happens to bodies. And the person to tell him what these things were is his driver. In other words, a working class person who's totally down. So he's like, yeah, you know, kid, this is old age, sickness, and death. And the Buddha's question to his driver every time is, will that happen to me? It's a good question. He's basically a teenager, right? And the driver says, yep, inevitably. And this torments the Buddha. And he actually says, how can I go on enjoying the pleasures of my privilege while I know that these things are true? I have to find a way to be happy. And then he goes on his search. So his description of practice starts with this same thing. It says, admit that there is loss, that there's death, that there's pain. And just wake up a teeny bit out of the denial of that, out of the constant search for new pleasures in order to not recognize reality. The truths go on to say that pain is actually caused primarily not by painful conditions per se, but by our response to them, right? And I might think about, you know, I've been going running lately, and there's always a point in the run where I just don't want to be running. It hurts. You know, I'm tired, but I keep running. And there's a different kind of running where I'm like, you know, running for a bus or running to get somewhere because I'm late and it hurts and I hate it. It's totally like, oh my God, I hate my life. I hate running for buses. It's like, ech, right? But sometimes you have to, you know, or sometimes I have had to. So then it's clear that it's not actually the ache in my belly or the pain of running that's really a problem. It's my attitude around it. It's the conditions around it. In the one, I have a story. This is for my health, right? This is for my well-being. And this is my precious time off, you know, and I'm spending it this way. And then the other, I'm like, I missed this, and I'm late, you know? Same sensation in a certain way. So the truth of grasping says, oh, the thing that actually hurts is not the loss itself, but is the clinging to it being otherwise. One modern practitioner said, suffering isn't the isn't that things are slipping out of your grasp. Suffering is rope burn. You're trying to hold on, and they're still slipping out of your grasp. So this formulation says it's actually possible to be free of this particular kind of torment, which is really, you know, not just like, oh, I have a, my attitude toward physical pain changes, but actually we could say, what are the deep, deep sufferings? You know, things like fear of death. And this of course, was the heart of what the Buddha was getting at. He said, I went to search for the deathless. So fear of death, right? This thing that like haunts us. And the practice suggests, we can say, that it's not actually death itself that is causing us to suffer. It's that fearing it is painful. So what do we do about that? You can't just suddenly not fear death. Although if I suggest it and then suddenly you're unafraid, you know, come and let me know. I would love to know that the talk is that powerful. This happened in the time of the Buddha. He would just say something and people would like get enlightened. The texts are a little bit exaggerated, or not, who knows? But they're, you know, it says, you know, he gave this Dharma talk, the monks said that it was wonderful, and at that very moment, 50,000 people saw the Dharma. I'm like, okay, this is excellent. I'm happy if a joke lands. Maybe it's the same thing, you know. Totally. So this is the beginning of wise view, is like, wake up a little bit to reality. So tonight I want to talk about another fold in this waking up to reality thing. When the Buddha sat down after 6 years of intense practice of many different kinds of yogic practice, meditation practices, physical practices, breath practices, when he finally sat down and in one long, charged night, again, this is a myth, so whatever that means, symbolically, he ended suffering, or he uprooted the tendencies towards suffering in his heart. The process is actually described in the texts in a very specific way, that he had three specific experiences in the uprooting of suffering. And they relate primarily to one concept. And that concept is a difficult one, so it's ridiculous that I'm bringing it in on beginner's night. But that concept is karma. The word literally means action. The root kr, kr, in Sanskrit and Pali, which is the early Buddhist language, refers to action. And it's a grammatical word. There's a version of the word that refers to the one who does an action in a sentence, and there's a word for the recipient of the action. So like, if the sentence is, I lift the clock, the I has one form of the word, and the clock has another form of the same word. It's like, I act, and this is the acted upon. And so the word starts as this simple grammatical term, then it gets used to mean the action of the ritual chanting and sacrifice in the Brahmanic system. And by the time of the Buddha, it's starting to take on a deeper philosophical meaning. And what it starts to point to is a question that was really debated in the spiritual circles of the time, and there were different answers to it. And the question, in a certain way, is what's the meaning of actions? Or what is the result of actions? Do our actions matter? These were questions that were put out. And these questions started to form themselves into different possible answers. One teacher went around saying, actions don't matter. There are no consequences to actions. That was kind of a nihilist view. Other teachers said, actions totally matter, and the results of actions are determined exactly by those actions. And that was a certain other view. The Buddha's view, which I'm biased because I like him, but I think is the best view on it, whatever best means, given the bit of study I've done of the other schools, I think it's a good view. I think it makes sense to me. And that view is that here we are in this moment, and this moment is composed of a certain experience for you, for each of us. And that experience has a tone or a quality to it, right? Like, my body is relatively comfortable, my mind is kind of excited, my heart is a little bit achy, like whatever it is for you, right? In minute detail, you know, the fact that sitting here right now, you chose this shirt to wear tonight, and now you have the experience of wearing this shirt. Or, you know, and so this is a way of speaking to what's called conditions. Conditions is a way of saying everything that's ever happened in the past has landed in this moment in this way. This itself is a radical teaching because it suggests that there, given the unfolding of things, it's not useful to say things should have been done differently or this moment should be different than it is. It's satisfying a bit to say it really should be that we had a different president right now. But it's difficult to say in precisely in relation to karma and conditions that it's not right or somehow that like a mistake was made that there's this president now. What we can say is conditions, which is just to say like the ecosystem of everybody's actions and the material world all coming together, has led to this. There's one modern teacher, a kind of sarcastic poet from the 60s, who said, he had a little poem, I'm not going to quote it correctly, Lew Welch. He said, so next time you're doing something utterly ordinary, like pissing, or cooking, or making love, or walking around, or opening the door, just think to yourself, so, it's all come to this. Right? Lew Welch. And this is conditions. Conditions have led to this. Whatever brought you here, here you are. That's the first part of the equation. The second part of the equation is, in this very moment, you have a little flicker of an open door. And that flicker is that you can choose what to do. Not in the future. You can't like choose what you're going to do next week because you don't know what the conditions are going to be next week. We could have a major earthquake. Yeah, who knows what's going to happen between now and next week. You can't control that. What you can choose is what you're going to do exactly now. And that's it. That's all you get. And to make it worse, your choice is conditioned by everything you've ever experienced. So, if my conditioning is to be a jerk, because I was like abused, or I grew up in a jerky kind of place, or whatever, even though I have the choice in this moment to be any particular way, there's some momentum toward jerkiness. And momentum is karma. Karma is a way of saying you're likely to continue doing what you've been doing. And to do something else takes energy, takes input somehow. So, karma is a way of saying your actions matter because they are going to condition what happens next. If I say something mean in this moment, the very next moment is going to be unpleasant in some way. Right? If I hurt someone, one of you or myself, in whatever way, in this moment, if I choose an action, which means maybe I don't choose, maybe it's so habitual I can't help it. Or it's so habitual I'm trying to help it, but it happens anyway. This is so much of our experience. That colors what happens next. And then I deal with the consequences. And what the Buddha found on his night of enlightenment was, first, that this is true. So the first thing he realizes in his evening of seeing clearly is that his own past consists of a constant flow of these moments, of choosing the next thing, of choosing the next thing, or being affected by conditions, doing the best one can, and then whatever happens, happens. This is partly why the doctrines that have been popular in the last decade or two around manifestation or the secret, that kind of thing, if those doctrines could be reduced to, if you want it hard enough, you get it. This is an added subtlety to that, which is that you can want it all you want, but conditions are what they are. You might get it, but conditions might thwart that. And if conditions thwart you getting what you want, it's not your fault. Right? The fact that you were hurt as a child is not your fault. This is conditions. This is the climax of Good Will Hunting. Robin Williams, Matt Damon, therapy conference. I love a movie that climaxes in the therapy room. Right? I like a movie that climaxes with a stoic man crying. Once on an airplane, and you watch whatever's on the airplane, right? So I was watching this movie. It's a Kevin Costner movie about the Coast Guard. And what, Kevin Costner is the old Coast Guard veteran. He's drawn in for one last thing. There's the young punk who he trains, grudging respect. The punk has father issues. Costner has kid issues. They da-da-da-da. In the end, Costner gives his life for the kid. I totally cried. Yeah. My wife teased me for 10 years. She was like, yeah, you cry at Kevin Costner. I'm like, I don't. But, you know, a guy's got father issues. You cry. You just do it, right? That's conditions. That's Kevin Costner. I never admitted that before. There you go. So, part of what this points to is that the process of our actions having results must, in order for the whole system to make sense, it must go beyond this individual lifetime. If our actions only affected the future while we are alive, and then whatever momentum we are part of just ended, there would be no need to seek liberation. There would be only a need to be patient for 100 years at most, and then you're done, no matter what happened. So part of the question in the Buddha's time was, what happens to us after we die? Do we continue? Do we end? Is there a soul that's eternal in each of us or not? And this was huge, because all of these traditions were about how do we become free of this thing called fear of death. And if just dying was the answer to it, and then like, ta-da, no matter whether you were afraid of it or not, it's going to happen, and then you don't have to worry about it ever again. Why work so hard at liberating? So the Buddha's first insight on his night of awakening is phrased in the texts something like this. And then in the first watch of the night, I saw my manifold past lives. One life, 10 lives, 100 lives, 1,000 lives, 100,000 lives. In each life, I was born. I had a name. I had an occupation. I ate these things. I lived in this place. I died in this way. And I was reborn as a result of my actions in this place, eating these things with this name, doing this, and I die. And that's the first vision. And this is why searching for the deathless was even a thing. Because if you really take on this teaching, this view of karma, it suggests that your actions have been adding to the momentum that you are now experiencing forever, and will keep adding to it forever. In other words, you will never be free of the cycling around of birth and death, of loss, of pain, of temporary pleasures, of inevitable pains, until you figure something out about this. And that was the goal, the deathless. Figure something else out about this life and death thing. So the Buddha sees infinite past lives. The second of the Buddha's realizations was, and then in the second watch of the night, I saw how beings pass on as a result of their actions. So he first sees it individually. He sees his own progression of states and qualities. And then he sees it for others. So if it was just true for him, there might be the doubt, maybe that's just me. But he sees that it's a universal thing. So, and the text really says that this is an insight. It's also a thing that one can learn to see with concentration. And there are formal techniques for seeing one's past lives. The teacher that I know that teaches them says, it's really okay. You don't have to see hundreds of thousands of them. Four or five is usually enough. And she says this in the most matter-of-fact way. And I can say that I know several people who have done this practice. Make of that what you will. And one thing to say about it is that one of the ways that it's hard to accept is if we think really literally about it. But I like to think of it in terms of, an ecosystem, or like a forest. Right? Like if an oak tree makes an acorn that falls and makes another oak tree. This is my metaphor now, I'm a new parent. There's another oak tree in my house. Apparently I made an acorn. And now it's growing up, so I have a sapling. And we think, that the baby is a different being than the parents. And at a certain point, they seem like a different being. My baby is now saying, no! Aww. I know. It's really nice. It's really nice. Do you want a little more yam? No. And I'm like, cool. That's fine. It's very dramatic. Because you have to figure it out. Like, no. And I'm all about, like, I respect your no. Consent is beautiful. And sometimes I'm like, I respect your no, but we're getting in the car, right. But there's this sense that's starting to grow. He's 15 months old. There's this sense that's starting to be there that he and his mother are not the same person anymore. Mm-hmm. From the beginning, it was a little bit clearer that he and I weren't the same person, but the two of them were, when one of them was happy, the other one was happy. One of them got sad, and the other one got sad. And like, they were essentially one nervous system. Because of course, they were one nervous system. And there's not a clear line where one becomes two. So, what is momentum? The momentum of our actions, anyway. When I was thinking about whether I wanted to have a child, I was thinking a lot about reincarnation. And I thought, oh, maybe this is what that is, partly. That, like, I'm making the choice. If all of us are something like the twig at the end of a fractal tree, where there's been a constant splitting and a spreading and a 8.5 billion twigs now growing out of this, each one connected to where it came from. And I choose not to continue. My twig just ends. And that's fine. I was like, I'm actually okay with that. But it's a really different thing if I let one sprout off from me and continue, because mine's going to die, and that one maybe continues, and maybe that one has another one. And I felt like, oh, having a child is sort of like, you know, like, to shift metaphors from the tree metaphor, I thought about myself sort of as a ball, like, let's say, in lawn bowling. And I'm rolling along, and I'm colliding with other balls, and I'm just sort of, I've got whatever momentum I've got, and eventually I stop. And I'm like, oh, having a child is like taking a fresh ball and just hurtling it into the future. And like, what's going to happen? I don't know. Like, where's it going to go? Who's he going to touch or collide with? And I was like, oh, my main wish really is that I do the best I can to throw well, which kind of means ethically, right? To make the conditions that his life will be somehow charged with goodness, that he does something good for the world. And it's up to him, who knows, right? But so far he's good. So the Buddha sees that his own momentum has been infinite. And again, going back to those first noble truths, the momentum of lifetime to lifetime is caused by craving. The idea is, if in this moment I want something, that wanting is the seed of my actions, right? I want you to laugh, therefore I start thinking of a joke, right? And then I tell the joke, and then I experience the pleasure or pain of the result of that action, right? Whatever it is. I see somebody across the street, they look like they might be my friend, I go up and I try to sort of start that ball rolling, right? And whatever happens, happens. Every single moment we're doing this. And so the idea is, the more I want, or we could say the more confused or tortured my wantings, the more contorted my actions will be, the more painful the results. What would happen in this moment if I needed nothing out of the next moment? If I stopped needing any particular response from anybody? If I stopped even craving staying alive? I don't immediately die, and I don't immediately leave relationship, actually. I could suddenly not need anything from you, and we'd all still be here doing things together. But maybe I would do it from a different place in my heart, a different peacefulness. And the Buddha said when he found what he wanted, when he found the deathless, he said, this is peaceful. This is good. And he didn't disappear. He didn't, like, wander off and do nothing. He walked around northern India for 45 years teaching everybody who came by. He got involved in politics. He tried to stop a war. He protested. He built monasteries. He taught thousands and thousands of people. He created a community with complicated bylaws. He dealt with schisms in the community and inner politics of the community. He got grumpy with his monks and walked out on them. He wasn't aloof at all. But he said, something is different. I no longer need anything from anybody. So he sees that the momentum of his own actions, his own karma, has caused this momentum that's gone on for endless births. He sees that that's true for everybody. This is also a very beautiful way to stop blaming people for being jerks. In a complicated, and this is ethically charged, way, it's not their fault. That doesn't mean they're not responsible for their actions. We're all absolutely responsible for our actions in this moment. You must recognize that you do have a choice about what to do. and that what you actually manage to do is still colored by your conditions. This morning I thought, as I was listening to the news, nobody actually wants to be a paranoid, narcissistic autocrat that the whole world hates. What people want is to be, you know, a powerful, respected leader who has lots of power and whom nobody questions, maybe. Maybe sane people want that. I don't know. But does this guy actually want to be paranoid? And I thought, like, oh, he doesn't. He's doing the best he can. And I think he's confused in some ways, you know. But I'm like, what are the conditions that led to this? They are fraught with pain. Again, this is charged. That it doesn't excuse anything. In the afternoon, I heard a bit of an interview with this guy who wrote a book called Blitzed. It's a history of the Nazis and drugs. And it's looking at evidence that not only lots of soldiers, but Hitler himself were jacked on amphetamines from like 41 through 45, and that Hitler's own condition got worse and worse and worse until he was being prescribed kind of piles of uppers, of amphetamines and other things, opiates and amphetamines. And really talking about an aspect of this history that, like, hasn't been as revealed before, was known, but has really been kind of brought out. And to think, like, oh, it's so easy to ascribe to someone like that, our sort of archetypal evil person, a kind of pure, sober evil. And then to be like, this guy was miserable. And like, popping pills and paranoid, the whole, like, you know, and I'm like, oh, like, the whole thing is painful. The result of his actions, tremendously painful, inside and out. And something softens that the Buddhist tradition loves and calls compassion. And again, it's a charged compassion to say, I have compassion for Hitler. It's more appropriate to say I have compassion for all the people he harmed, but that would be to take a limited view. And this tradition keeps expanding its view and says, yes, but look deeper. The causes of suffering are why there is suffering. So the Buddha sees how this works. And in the third watch of the night, it says, in the third watch of the night, I uprooted completely the causes of this momentum in my own heart. Greed, hatred, and delusion. It's said that these forces live in us because of momentum, because of conditions, because of culture, because of family, because of having a body. They're part of how the simple truth of having a body has been torqued by experience into something painful. We can see through this. We can uproot that confusion. And continuing to have a body, continuing to be an oak tree among oak trees, continuing to be in the ecosystem because we were never out of it. The body's going to become compost and more things will grow, and it goes on like that. And my actions, my words, everything I've said tonight, whether right or wrong, is now yours, and you'll do with it what you will, right? And the momentum of that will go on and on and on. Everything we do has momentum. So what is it that ends? What is it that the Buddha says, I ended this, I uprooted this? After he woke up, he said, this is too subtle, no one's going to get it. Right? It's not big, but it's paradigm shifting, to use a postmodern Silicon Valley kind of word. It's disruptive in a really big way. So here's the encouragement. Thanks, beginners, for hanging with us. talk on the philosophy of karma, your first night in. Welcome. It turns out to be really simple. Everything we do has an effect. So, be careful. Or be loving. Or do the best you can. So, thanks for listening. Pleasure. Let's take just a moment to rest in silence together again. For the last part of our time together, just an open field for reflections that may be questions or may not be, maybe just the way that any of this material bubbles through your own practice, your own body this evening, or for anything that's arising in your practice. Yeah, Caitlin.
When you're talking about past lives and reincarnation, I was thinking about other like frameworks for exploring past lives or like remembering past lives. And I've been thinking about like hypnotherapy. I mean, not necessarily doing it myself, but just like thinking about the existence of hypnotherapy and like past life astrology and frameworks like that, and where you're sort of, instead of, you know, this more like experiential way maybe of bringing up those experiences through meditation, it's more of a intellectual framing.
Maybe.
I don't know. But I was just curious what your thoughts on that would be.
Yeah.
If they're like,
I don't dismiss anything. But I also don't take everything literally, you know. If we took it literally, there would be an awful lot of people who've done past life regressions who were all Cleopatra, you know. But it's not like that. It's more like, or at least maybe they all were, because that's a person who had a lot of momentum. Like, we don't know how it works. You know, one oak tree makes a lot of acorns. But it's so tempting to think that the information we're getting in a mystical way has to conform somehow to our very narrow view of things that's basically grammatical. You know, I am this means I'm singular, means I'm separate, all of these implications that, like, I only really know how to think about things a certain way. But, like, if I have a dream that I'm Cleopatra, does it mean that I was Cleopatra? Or does it mean that the image of Cleopatra is important to me? Or that, you know, or that the deity called Cleopatra is visiting me? Or that my culture as a colonial force in relation to Egypt is revealing its poison through me in a Jungian memory of Cleopatra? Like, what is it? We don't know, actually. Even if I believe the texts, and say, oh, the Buddha saw his past lives, that's too simple, right? Because the thing that he realizes is that there's no eternal, singular individual that passes through all those things. So what was it? Maybe what he did was he remembered his genealogy, right? And maybe part of what I should do if I want to practice that is, and this is not the literal practice of it, but symbolically, if I took it more metaphorically, one of the ways to understand this, and this is canonical, this appears not just in modern psychology, but in early texts, you can think of this as in a moment-by-moment way. And sometimes I'll do this, and I'll do this with students. And it'll be like, think of yourself now, and then think of yourself, you know, last year. Think of your hairdo last year. Think of the shape of your body last year, the shape of your thoughts, what you were doing, what you thought about your relationship. And then, like, notice that it's just different. different person. If I think about myself at 28, you know, I was a mess. But I was like a whole different person. If I think about myself at 22, I was passionate about the neo-romantic classical music of Lutosławski and the new Polish avant-garde. And like, cool, 22. When I feel it now, it just feels so distant, like so profoundly not me. But I can feel in me the momentum of that, right? When something particular comes on the radio and I have this gut feeling and I go, I hate classical music. I wouldn't say that had I not like wanted to get into orchestras as a teenager and been obsessed by Lutosławski and then moved on to Morton Feldman and then John Cage and then dropped it. Right? Or maybe it wouldn't have been that if I had like wanted to get into conservatory but wasn't good enough. Like everything is conditioned by the past. Maybe I've had so many past lives. And maybe actually every single moment is like that, is the implication. And this is a particular Vipassana practice. It's essentially to notice that every single moment you're a different being. And they talk about the arising and passing of thoughts or sensory experiences in the same language as of birth and death. Like, I look over at you, and the image of you is born. Or I am born as the one seeing you. And then that persists for a micro moment. And already we're different. And now I've died as the one who's seeing you. And I've gone on to the one seeing you. I've been reborn as the one seeing you. And this is a way of talking about the endless momentum of psychophysical process. That, you know, again, if you use any ecosystem model, there's no way to talk about exactly what happens at the moment of death. What happens? You know, there's a physical process that we can kind of measure. Where do I go? You know, lots of reports about what happens. You know, who knows? So I take all of that stuff as like, those are all tools, all the hypno anythings. And rather than deciding that one is right or wrong, because who am I to decide that? Mostly, I just want to know if they're useful, you know. And when I go useful, I say, are they useful on the path? Because that's the framework, it's the view that I've taken on. And again, your view determines what you do next. So if you have a view that you have an eternal soul that's moved through different bodies, then you're going to do certain practices in relation to that view, etc. So yeah, don't know. Yeah. Other thoughts?
Yeah. Just having a thought about karma. This might—I know it's one of the imponderables. This might be a question that doesn't really have an understandable answer.
The imponderables is a short list in Buddhism of four things that are so impossible to figure out that if you try, your brain will explode.
So when the Buddha reached enlightenment, or when anyone reaches enlightenment, it means he reached the end of his karma.
That's the idea.
And therefore, after that, though, he continued to do things in the world that had real effects, that of course last until this day.
Here we are.
So how is it that those actions left no karmic imprints?
Right. So precisely working out the nature of karma is one of those imponderables. It says you can't figure it out. Add to that that people would come to the Buddha and they would say, so you're liberated. When you die, what happens to you? And he'd be like, it's not the right question. Because if he said, I disappear, that would lead to folks taking up a nihilistic viewpoint. If he said, something about me persists, like this momentum, that would lead to folks misinterpreting that in an eternalistic way. Like, oh, there's something about you that's eternal. There were times when he just refused to answer the question. There were times when he kind of answered by not answering. But it's the sense that I get from it is that when we say karma, we don't actually mean that things continue happening. What I think we mean is things continue to happen because I'm tormented. And so if he stops being tormented, everything keeps happening. But this gets really... Sorry, beginners. The entity who thought that himself as an individual was doing this wakes up to not being an individual doing it. In other words, the oak tree is tormented about its children, right? Oh my God, there's a beetle, it's killing us. I have to make better acorns. I got to do this better. I got me to sink deeper roots. The oak tree realizes, zooms out, has a great, fabulous experience, zooms out, sees the forest, sees the whole earth, sees climate change, sees the whole universe folding and unfolding in unfathomable waves of being, expansion and contraction. And the oak tree's like, oh. And just drops it, the idea that it was a separate individual doing something. Keeps on dropping acorns, keeps on being an oak tree, just doesn't think about it anymore. Right? It was just wrong. And the idea is, nothing really changes. You were just mistaken about reality. Everything continues happening. A very concrete example of this is that the Buddha has this student, you I think know this story, he meets up with this serial killer, Angulimala, who's killed 999 people. Angulimala tries to kill the Buddha as the 1,000th, and the Buddha converts him, turns him into a monk, and within a couple weeks, Angulimala practices and is enlightened, fully liberated. Meaning he's liberated from his own karma. Right? He stops creating, and he created hella bad karma, right? Killing all those people. So he's an enlightened monk. He goes into the town where a lot of relatives of the people he killed live. He's begging for alms. And people recognize him, even in his monk's robes, and they throw rocks at him, and they cut him, and he gets beaten up. And he goes back to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, bear it. Though you are liberated, you, this body, is still receiving the karmic results of your actions. It's really interesting. He has stopped creating further momentum, but the momentum he created continues. And it continues to affect him, even. And then he becomes the patron saint of women having a hard time in childbirth, which is very strange. Or perfect, somehow, right? When my wife and I were going into labor, we called the nuns that we have a relationship to, and they said, we're going to chant the Angulimala blessing for you. They did. Right. And it's interesting to know that modern feminist nuns are chanting a verse of praise to a 2,500-year-old serial killer in order to bless us with a smooth birth. Yeah.
So what you were just describing about kind of the oak tree getting fixated so much on its little acorns, but then having a larger view and stepping back, it reminded me of kind of something I'm experiencing now with an aspect of my practice, and actually might help beginners orient
please
a little more. So I've been taking Qigong, and like one of the things the teacher says is sometimes like feel the tips of your fingertips, but in order to do that, imagine your fingers are extending like way to like the other side of the city. And she says she does that because for beginners, a lot of times you have to think so much bigger, otherwise you won't be able to feel your fingertips.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and I thought that was interesting, and it's also, but it also creates this like difficulty for me because in a way it helps me get more in touch with reality and like that actual physical sensation of feeling my fingertips, but at the same time it feels so unreal to imagine like my fingers extending that far, or this idea that I'm expanding my view to see like the earth or you know, something like that. It's just like, it doesn't feel realistic, but at the same time it
totally.
I'm just not sure
Yeah.
What that is.
Absolutely, it's doubt. And that's because so far you're using your imagination to do it. Mm-hmm. And imagination is pretty flimsy. Yeah. I imagine I'm Gandalf. Yeah. You know, it doesn't last, right? This is something that also never gets taught on, and I shouldn't say it, but in the early texts, the supernatural powers of, like, you know, clairvoyance and you know, reading minds and all that are really emphasized. Why? Part of it is actually that it is possible to have a direct experience of the reality of this thing, not just imagination, but to know it directly by cultivating the mind that is that powerful. In other words, if you actually can, you know, open your awareness to the whole world and hear the chattering of everybody's minds all at once and see, the texts call it, with the divine eye that is purified and greater in capacity than the human. If you can get that power, and the texts from many traditions are full of people with this power, so who am I to doubt it? I can't do it, but that doesn't mean I need to believe it doesn't exist. We might say, oh, that power is the proof. And actually, there are teachers in the commentarial tradition that say the reason to cultivate those powers is that that's the only way to actually get it in your bones that karma is correct. You have to actually know it. You have to have the experience the Buddha had of seeing it work. Not just imagine it and not just believe it, but actually kind of really see it. And you need a powerful mind to do that. So develop supernatural powers, people. And on that note, we should close.
See you next week.
Next week, we'll look at the second limb in the Eightfold Path. This is the limb of intention. We're gonna get grounded here. We're going to go intention and then action, livelihood, speech, like really the gritty. We'll do relational for the next month. So thanks for being here. It's really a pleasure to hang out with you. Thank you. This group, unlike everything else at the studio, is offered fully on the profound practice of gift economy. That means that you're invited to practice with your own generosity and letting go. Nothing in capitalism prepares you for this, which is partly why we do it. You're offered to give of your resources so that others can continue to come with such an open door. So thank you for your generosity. Donations go in the basket on the shelf and are split in half between the studio and myself. Thanks for folding blankets neatly. Feel free to come anytime. See you.